Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. So it's great to see everyone. Happy New Year. It's 2019, and I saw a really funny meme with a Moses-looking character who's holding a Torah scroll and a shofar, and, I'm forgetting the line. The line was something like, it was a one-liner. It said something like, New Year's? That was 4 months ago. Something like that. It's not that funny as I say it now. I realize the picture, there might have been a catchier line. But anyway, Happy New Year. It's good to see everyone. And it's great to get back into things and start new things as well.
I'm going to celebrate the trees and cow thing. New Year's.
What?
There are four New Year's.
Oh, yeah, exactly. There are a lot of interesting New Year's. By the way... Yes, so I was going to say, by the way, so you should know, so in Jewish law, it talks about different New Years, and it talks about New Years for trees. And that is on Tu B'Shvat, which is the 15th day of Shvat. And so tonight and tomorrow is the first day of Shvat. So if we're looking at the 15th, it's basically in 2 weeks' time. So 2 weeks from tomorrow is Tu B'Shvat. And also, parenthetically, Trees Atlanta... always does. Sorry. What is the official group? I don't. I know Myrtle Lewin does it. But it's Trees Atlanta. In conjunction with the Jewish community of Atlanta, there is a special Jewish tree planting on Tu B'Shvat every year. And it's going to happen Monday, 2 weeks from Monday, which is on MLK Day. And it's very cool. And I usually take my teens from our teen group, and we usually plant. And it's a lot of fun, and it's a mitzvah. And the Jewish trees that we plant, they're very interesting, because most trees, you plant them and they grow. The Jewish trees, they start kvetching. They're like, oh, come on. But I need this. What?
Water,
you miss
water.
Some dirt. Where's the water? What, I have to stand here all day? What, there's no chair? So it's
seltzer.
Fun. Seltzer. I need something. It's funny, because now LaCroix, or whatever like that, seltzer, has taken off. Anyway, I feel like...
Are all the flavors kosher?
Yeah, I feel like we've been co-opted, though. But whatever. Let's jump now into... It's fine, I'll deal with it. You know what they say, a Jew is someone who has a chip on both of their shoulders. You know what the Jewish waiters... A waiter. One more, last one, and then we're jumping into Kabbalah. What does a waiter say at a Jewish restaurant? It comes around to the tables. Is anything okay? Okay, fine. That's it. Now we jump in. Kabbalah and coffee. So imagine a scene where it's a windy day, and you have a plastic bag, or that's not so eco-friendly. Imagine you have a bag. I think it works better with plastic, but maybe a paper bag that's floating in the air. Have you ever seen that? Like, it's a windy day, it's a blustery day, and you have something, an object, an item, and it's now just floating in the air. It's almost dancing in the air. Right? Imagine it's dancing in the air. And it's a beautiful sight, and you're mesmerized by it. You're thinking, like, such an interesting, poetic, fluid sight, this bag kind of dancing and turning and twisting and flipping in the air. And then you say to yourself, I know what this is. This is a once-in-a-lifetime moment. I have encountered a dancing bag. Most bags aren't dancing bags, but I've now encountered, for the first time in my life, I've encountered a dancing, flying, floating bag. If I told you that, what would you tell me? That I've encountered a dancing bag. Quickly capture this and upload this to YouTube. What would you say?
Oh, sleep it off.
Yeah, sleep it off, right? It's not a dancing bag. What is it? It's a bag. And blowing in the wind. In other words, is the bag dancing? Or is the wind carrying the bag through the air?
The wind is leading.
Or the wind is leading the bag through the air. Fine.
Oh, no, leading as in dancing.
Oh, leading.
Well, both.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah. I mean, because of...
I know what you mean. It takes two to tango.
It takes the bag. Yes. Were they tangoing them?
I don't know. I don't know.
A bit of a more freestyle.
My Dancing with the Stars is a little bit... It's a little bit rusty. It's been a few years.
They're just going for it.
So here's the thing. One could say, And they might be correct in saying that it's that without the wind, right? Without the wind, the bag is not going to do anything without the wind. If the wind would stop, or when the wind stops, the bag is going to rest back on the ground, still and silent as before.
So really you only know the wind is there because of the bag.
The animation of the bag. Right? The bag is only animated. The movement and the animation of the bag is only due to the wind. There's nothing inherent within the bag that is making itself animated. It's not like the bag has suddenly gained the power of movement. And what's the word? Pirouetting? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes. Good job.
Right? Which is like what's spinning, right?
Yes.
That's spinning. It's not like the bag has gained the power of movement and dance and pirouetting and flying and floating and soaring. The bag is just a bag. It's the wind that's making it float, that's making it move. In a very similar way, and of course this is not a perfect analogy, but it's something to at least start the conversation. So in a similar way is the notion of existence, the way Kabbalah frames existence. Everything that looks real, everything that looks like it's animated and moving. Alex, can you close? Thanks.
So
appreciate it.
To me, it's so normal. You don't even notice it.
Yeah, but it's... Don't worry, it'll still be there. It's not going anywhere. So everything that looks like it's in existence, that looks like it is, that looks like it's real, things move, things change, things speak, people speak, communicate, and think. And everything that looks so real, Kabbalah explains, is in fact only real or powered or alive or animated because of the divine life force that flows through it. Like the wind that grants animation and movement to that plastic bag or paper bag, so too is the divine energy and life force that flows through all being. That's what makes things animated, and that's what makes things things. Without that force, that thing would not be. The difference is, the fundamental difference is that when it comes to the wind in the bag, take away the wind, the bag still exists. Even if it's not moving, the bag is still a bag. It doesn't need the wind to be a bag. But take away the divine life force from existence. And it's not just that existence collapses into an inert state where it's still and silent like a bag sitting on the ground until it's reanimated. No. Take away the divine life force and everything ceases to be absolutely. In other words, matter itself ceases to be matter. That thing, which is a thing, becomes nothing, no thing. So existence is undone without the divine life force. I want to give you another example. Imagine a puppet, right? It's similar to the bag example. Same example, just a different example. So imagine a puppet, or like the real puppets. Well, no. Yeah. What's it called?
Marionette.
Marionette? I don't even know her. Who's Annette? Okay. That's usually my go-to with Marietta. Marietta? I don't even know her. All right.
Oh, I just got it.
Yeah, Marionette. I figured I should do a second iteration, like my two examples with the bag and the puppet. So you have the puppet. So what does the puppet do on its own? It just sits there. But now you have a puppeteer pulling the strings, and now the puppet is moving and dancing, whatever puppets usually do when their strings are being pulled. So without the force, without the puppeteer's intervention, the puppet is not doing anything. Once you have the intervention of the puppeteer, that the pulling of the strings, etc., now you have movement, and now you have animation, and now it becomes a thing. Again, in a very similar vein, you have this notion of existence. See, we take existence for granted. Our perspective is all of this exists, and all of this is real, and all of this moves and grows, and you know, the wind blows, and the trees grow, and the sun shines, and the birds chirp, and we move around, and we tie. We take all this stuff for granted. Kabbalah tells us that everything that's moving, everything that is breathing, that's alive, which includes, as we've explained many times, even a rock that's sitting on the ground that shows outwardly no signs of animation, even that is considered to have a soul and be alive. All of that is powered by a divine life force. And again, without the divine life force, not only, this is where it goes beyond the examples that I'm giving, not only does it lie still and silent without any animation and movement, but even more so, it would cease to exist. And more than that, as we've explained, its entire history would cease to exist. Since time is all intertwined, once God, if God, not once, but if God were God to stop creating something at any moment, that thing would be undone absolutely, including its entire history within time. So it would be as though it never was. Not only would it be from here on no longer, but it would be as it never was. I want to share with you a related idea, related to this that's tied also into the Torah portion that we just read yesterday. So yesterday, in synagogues around the world, the story of the plagues was read. This is a major piece of the Exodus from Egypt, the 10 plagues. 7 out of the 10 plagues were read yesterday in the Torah portion. The 7th plague was the plague of hail. The plague of hail was a very unique plague. Not only were there large hailstones, but within the hail was fire. All the plagues were miraculous. This was a miracle within a miracle. Not only do you have your standard miracle hail plague, but God takes it to the next level and he says, you know what? And within the hail, we're going to put fire. So what happened was, it broke all of the huts and all of the houses, whatever that they had. And then once the ice broke it, right, breaking the ice, then the fire burnt everything down. So it was a double whammy right there, the fire and the ice. And mystically, of course, there's a lot of symbolism, the fire and the ice, and what does it mean, and what does it stand for? Okay.
And when it stopped, it rained. That was my favorite part.
Well, hold on. Actually, one second. You know what it says? So Pharaoh says to Moses, you got to make this stop. You got to love Pharaoh. You'll see what I mean in a moment. Pharaoh is, he's the ultimate. He's like, Moses, ask God to stop this plague and I'll let you go. They stop the plague and Pharaoh's like, you know what? About that. It's like the guy who's looking for a parking spot. You know this one? This is a classic. Guy's looking for, he has a meeting. He's looking for a he's late for a meeting. Very important meeting. He needs a parking spot. He's in the parking lot. There's no spots. He's panicking. He's like, I need a spot. He starts praying to God. God, please, I need a spot. No spot, no deal, no dice. He's like, you know, God, if you give me a spot, I'll go to synagogue. No spot. I'll go for 2 weeks, nothing. 3 weeks, nothing. A whole month, I'll go. Every Shabbat, I'll go. Finally, a spot opens. As he's circling around, guy pulls out. He pulls in. He says, God, you know what? Forget it. I got a spot already. It's good. That's Pharaoh, right? Pharaoh's like, Moses, pray, stop the plague, and I'll let you go. The plague stopped. Pharaoh's like, you know what? Things are okay. I'm not going to let you go. This is Pharaoh. You got to love him. He's very committed to his deal. The Rebbe once said, if you want to learn commitment and perseverance, learn from Pharaoh. I mean, don't exactly learn from Pharaoh in every detail, but the trait of, you know, sticking things through and not stopping no matter what, you can learn from Pharaoh. You can learn something from everybody. So, the hailstones. Moses prays, and this is like the second to last verse of the Torah portion. It says, he prayed, and the hail and the plague stopped. V'hamatar, or v'habarar, lo nitach arza. It says that the hail did not reach the ground. In other words, think about it. Any precipitation, rain, snow, hail, it's got a bit of a journey, right? So imagine, Moses prays to God to stop the plague, and God says, okay, the plague is stopped. I have a question for you. What about the hail that's already, help me out here?
Hailing
in the air, right? It's already coming down. Does that hail still hit? Because it's already in progress. But if it, so it would make sense logically for that, for no new hail to be generated, but the old hail, right? There's new hail, old hail, but old hail should still fall down. However, if the old hail that's still that's currently in the air hits the ground, that means that Egypt is getting hit after God has officially stopped the plague, pulled the plug on the plague. That works. Alliteration. So what's the story? So the Torah tells us clearly, v'hamatar, which means the rain, or v'habar, I don't remember which word is used, loy nitach artsa. Whatever was in the air didn't reach the ground. Can you imagine? Do you know what that looks like? Hailstones hanging in the air. You realize this vision? It's not. It doesn't say that they went back up. Like God's like, okay, let me take all that stuff back. No. The hailstones froze. They froze in the air.
Is it another possibility that they disappeared?
Well, I think Carol's right in that they stood in the air, and then after a while, remember what was inside the hail? The fire? It probably burnt the hail, and then at some point it just came down as light precipitation.
From what you were saying before, stopping it means that it no longer exists.
That's exactly where I was going with this. When it comes to Egypt, God didn't undo the totality of the hail. He just stopped it from now on, moving forward. There are two types of teshuva. Two types of, I don't like the word repentance. Oh, I just said it. Two types of return. Okay? One is where I say, from now on, I'm no longer going to do that. So what happened in the past, I did and happened. But from now on, I'm no longer going to do that thing. That's suspended hailstones. The hailstones are still in the air. The past is still there. Whatever started to come down, whatever came down in the past, all of that still exists. But from now on, those hailstones aren't hitting, moving forward. There's a higher level of teshuvah that undoes the past, similar to how God undoes the past. Were God to undo absolutely the existence of a thing, not just stop a plague, but undo something, its past would be undone. That's a deeper level of teshuvah, where we actually go back, in a sense, and rewrite the past. And a simple way of understanding this is, in a relationship, if a person does something that hurts the other person, right? Let's say a person says something not so nice to someone that's close to them, so that's a negative, that blemishes, that causes a mark on the relationship. So a person can say, wow, I can't believe I did that. I will never do that again. So the hailstones are still there. They struck, and even the suspended ones might still be somewhere in the air. But from now on, no more hailstones. I'm committing no more hailstones for me. I'm not going to say that again or do that again. I won't be so insensitive, etc. Moving forward. There's another type of teshuva. So that's kind of change from now on, but the past is still there. A deeper form of teshuva is where I say, you know, because of what I said, and because of the pain that I see within the other person, because of the damage that I know that I caused, that is stirring me, that is inspiring me to be a much better person for myself, and so much better and more loving and more sensitive to the other person, more than had I never said that in the first place. In other words, that action, which was negative, is actually putting me in a more positive place than I would have ever been had I never stumbled in that negative space. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And in that case, this was the best thing to ever happen to the relationship. If I can pull this off, obviously we should never go into this with the intention of, well, I'll leverage this for something even. That's not a wise move. But, and I think we all have these experiences in our own lives that we can, in a sense, a different example. you know, when it comes to a job or it comes to any challenge in life, a person can say that in the moment that was a devastating or a very difficult time, but in retrospect, that led me to a place that I would have never gotten to had that not happened. And in looking back, that was actually, for me, now that I have a different perspective and I'm in a different place, that was actually a blessing and not a curse in my life. That means rewriting the past, in a sense, undoing the past. The hailstones were not destructive. They were a blessing. I'm not saying it happened in Egypt, but I'm saying in our own lives, that's a way to undo the past, to kind of mirror. Obviously, it's not totally undoing the past because there was a moment in time where it was painful, either for us or for someone else. But on some sort of level, it's kind of like undoing the past and mirroring that. So again, think of these two visuals. Either hailstones, hail suspended in the air, frozen, right? Because you've only stopped it from now on. Or the hail being undone and all the damage, in a sense, on the ground being undone because of the incredible power of transformation that is occurring. Yeah.
So it seems that both of those are still very pragmatic because they're based on the existence of the past. But I'm wondering if there's a deeper or another level where the past, what you're saying, is no longer...
Doesn't even exist. I don't know that we can reach that on our own. God can pull that off. I think for us, I don't know.
Because of the ripple effect, I have that problem with Asaph. Like, so what? He did Shuva to the point that's like so great that, you know, he was forgiven. But look at the ripple effect. Look what was left.
Now, right.
Who am I to say? Did the universe do that because those are challenges and pivotal things in other people's lives that I really have nothing to do with?
Right.
Shut up and stay on my own path.
Right.
But it does bother me.
Right.
Because, yeah, okay, so, but still, what you did in the past has a tremendous ripple effect
right.
on life and the world. So
I understand what you're saying. You're saying sometimes it's not so easy to undo something or to transform something. There are other ramifications that have spread out already, yeah.
Like, but Egypt still destroyed.
Right.
Even though it turned to...
So they didn't do tshuva, obviously, that was so deep. It was more of like, in the moment, okay, fine. And then he reverted anyway. But I understand your question. Your question is, can we reach a place where, or a state where the past not only is transformed, but the past is almost totally gone? There is no past.
And even made better.
I don't know.
You can't have the past without the present and the future. So the past will always be there.
Well, the question is, yeah.
I think that it looks like, I think it's in the context of the larger conversation about time.
Yeah.
Itself. But I think that our conversation here is pragmatic. When I say pragmatic, it's that real life situations.
Right.
Living in a world where we think that there's a past, present, and future. It seems that in addition, though, there's almost another level of study, which isn't necessarily that we would make, I don't think that we have that power, but that's sort of what the, at sort of a macro level or the meta level, that's really what, we're trying to understand this in the context of that. It's even hard to articulate what that is. But
yeah.
I feel like as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about, it's almost two conversations. One is at a very much more abstract, and abstract is
correct.
A limiting word for that.
Correct.
And the other is its practical value
right.
for us.
Right. So the discussion in this text is very abstract. When I say abstract, I mean it in the way that you mean it, in that it's a level and dimension that we can't... We're talking about, like, I think a good parallel to your point is the difference between the example that I gave and the analog, what the example's for. So when it comes to the bag floating in the air, again, it's only animated because of the wind. You take away the wind and the bag is not animated, but it still exists. Whereas in the example with God, without the divine life force, there is no bag. And that's a completely different level, right? That's hard to fathom how actual atoms and molecules and things could be undone due to something stopping. You know, you pull out a battery from a watch, the watch is still there. You unplug a refrigerator is still there. It's not working, but it's still there. Were God, and this is really the point, if God were to unplug from any element of creation, of existence, that existence would not just stop, it would cease to be altogether, and its entire time story would cease to be as well. Its entire history would cease as well. That's, and obviously, maybe not obviously, but the physical examples that we're giving are imperfect in that sense, in that it's kind of translating themes down to our experience, but certainly not on that level of undoing things, right? Do we have the power to undo something? Absolutely no. I mean, the closest we have is the example of light, which is an example that's going to come up soon in our text that we're going to study inside this morning. The best example we have for this is light, where when you turn off the light, immediately the light ceases to be. Whereas when you finish pouring water, the water still exists, right? You turn off the air conditioner, the room is still cool. Turn off the heat, the room is still hot. When you turn off the light, immediately it goes dark. It's an immediate disappearance of that reality. So light is probably the best example. When, you know, something's unplugged, it disappears. And it's as dark as if there was never light in that room. It's not like the room is brighter because for the last 24 hours the light was on. So now when I turn off the light, it's still a little bit bright. It's not a little bit bright. It's as dark as if the room had never had any light. So if were God to unplug from the universe or from even one element of the universe, that would go dark, and it's obviously not literally dark. It would be undone completely. It would go as dark as though it had never been light. It would be turned off like it would have never been turned on or created. So that's kind of how it works. That's why light is a favorite example and analogy of the Kabbalists. Okay, so that's by way of a little bit of an introduction. Let's jump in to our text inside. We're going to talk today about this topic, existence and being vis-a-vis the life force that makes it exist and makes it be. In other words, what is the relationship between a being and the life force that makes it a being? What does that relationship look like? What is the nature of that relationship? That's one topic. Another topic is the idea of bittul. Bittul is another favorite topic in Kabbalah. Bittul means, the typical translation, which I'm not crazy about, is nullification. What's nullification? It's kind of like, what's another word for nullification?
Void.
Void, an absence.
Population.
Yeah, you could also...
Void.
You can also call it a transparency, but it's more than transparency, because transparency implies that it's still there, but you can see through it, whereas this is kind of like... Bittul means abnegation, almost. It's like a total absence or loss of that thing. So we'll talk about bittul and two types of bittul. Bittul, there are two forms of bittul. One is called bittul hayesh, and the other one is called bittul hametzius. We'll talk about these two this morning as well. And finally, we'll talk about the sun and the relationship, between the sun and the light of the sun. What is the relationship between the sun itself and the light that emanates from the sun? All right, all coming up this morning, Kabbalah and Coffee. We started last time, we got together a few weeks ago, we started chapter 3 toward the end of the session. I want to pick it up from the beginning just to get a running start. So let's start. Does everyone have a copy or a book? Everyone's covered? Okay, fantastic. Please open up in the booklets. In the books, it's page 33. In the booklets, it's page 29. Typically, the way we do it is we read the paragraphs that follow the Hebrew text, but not necessarily the explanatory paragraphs in between that, which are in the normative text. We're typically reading the italicized text with some of the other words like in between, but not the paragraphs that are just explanation that I try to fill in. Okay, chapter 3. And just, yeah.
May I just ask, in the normal font,
yeah.
What is
the normal font?
Who's making those?
Yeah. The normal font is written by the is words of explanation interposed between the literal translation, and it's by Rabbi Yosef Weinberg, Schellenberg Weinberg, and edited by Uri Kaplan. So it's who the editors and the translators that prepared the text, and then they prepared introductory notes at the beginning of each chapter, at the end of each chapter, and also explanatory paragraphs in between as needed. But I'll do the explanation, you know, in my own way, and then we'll just basically try to read the translation itself. But I'm not going to be such a stickler about only reading the italicized words. We'll just read. Okay. Now, following these words of truth concerning the nature of creation, namely, that the activating force must continually be vested in created beings and create them ex nihilo. So again, the idea here is that the bag does not float without the wind, which translated into our reality or into the universe itself. Nothing exists without a divine life force making it exist. Don't take existence for granted. If it's alive, when I say alive, I mean if it exists, if we call it a thing or a being, either whether it's a heavenly being, heavenly body, sun, moon, stars, whether it's an earthly creation or creature, whether it's a microscopic thing, it doesn't matter. If it is, then there's something, a force that makes it, excuse my lack of grammar here, that makes it is. If it is, something is making it be, is. It's not just by itself. There's no such thing. And that force, he says, is continuously pulsing through it like a heartbeat, through a person, keeping a person alive with the blood flowing. You constantly need this force, this divine life force, flowing through it. Being that that is the case, let's advance it. Therefore, every discerning person will understand clearly that every creature and being, even though it appears to have an existence of its own, is in reality considered to be absolute not and nothingness in relation to the activating force which creates it and the breath of his mouth which is within it, continuously calling it into existence and bringing it from absolute non-being into being. In other words, the relationship, see, since everything that is has a force that's making it be, so what is the relationship between the thing and the force? The thing is really nothing without that force. Because if the force is not making it be, it won't be. Which means that its isness is not its own. Its isness is God's business. What was that? It's a bumper sticker. Anyway, its being, right? Its being is in reality only God's being. Again, the relationship between the bag and the wind that's blowing it and making it move is that the bag only moves because of the wind. So its power of movement and flight is not its own. It doesn't have the ability to fly. It doesn't have the ability to move or pirouette. It's only the wind that's doing that. It remains a bag that otherwise would just sit wherever you placed it. In a similar way, but obviously in a much larger way, the relationship between existence, being, things that are, and the divine life forces, that nothing truly exists on its own, the only true existence is the divine life force that flows through it and makes it be. Make sense? Sort of? Okay. Now we get into perception. Because here's the kicker. You and I perceive things as though they are. Let me say that in a clearer fashion. You and I perceive things as though they exist unto themselves. You and I see reality through a completely different lens than what we're talking about. You and I see a table as a table. We don't see a divine life force manifesting itself as a table. You and I see a table. You and I see a tree. A tree grows in the beltline. You and I see a park, a midtown. That's what we see. We don't see nothing that's being powered by a divine life force. We see all this stuff. So what's going on? So he says, the reason, let's continue, the reason that all things created and activated appear to us as existing, i.e. self-subsisting and tangible, and we fail to see the divine activating source, which is the true reality of any created being. So why do we see what we see? If the truth is that the wind is blowing the bag, why is it, and I mean that in the cosmic sense, that the divine life force is making everything from nothing into something? So why don't we see that? Why do we only see the something and we don't see the divine life force? So he says simply, the reason is that we do not comprehend nor see with our physical eyes the power of God and the breath of his mouth, which is in the created thing. You and I, our physical eyes can only see the physical part of things. And our mind can only comprehend, typically, our mind can only comprehend the physical manifestation piece of it. We don't comprehend in an immediate way, nor do we see in an immediate way the divine life force that's pulsing through it and animating it and bringing it into existence from absolute nothingness into somethingness at every moment. We don't see that. We don't have that type of x-ray vision, so to speak, that Kabbalistic, spiritual x-ray vision. All we see is the outside. We see a bag that's dancing and we say, wow, a dancing bag. That's what we see. We see a puppet that's moving. We say, oh, it's moving. We don't see the puppeteer. We don't see it.
So I'm wondering, I'm wondering about another way of thinking about that. So there's seeing and there's perceiving. So seeing is the sensation that, so could it, I'm wondering, is it possible that actually we do see that, but then when the stimuli, what we're seeing, is processed, which is in the visual system very complicated, that we give it that much more concrete meaning. And so in a way, what we may be seeing, we're not
understanding its truth.
So the difference between seeing and perceiving.
Very interesting.
Here, I mean, when it says, you know, with your eyes, but I wonder if just it was the way in which the language was written,
right,
that it's possible that given the limitations of our own brains,
right,
and the way in which we immediately assign meaning to something, or even if you look at a cloud, you can give it a form because we fill in different spaces to give
right.
meaning, that we have the potential to be able to see.
Maybe see it, but yeah, but we're
maybe seeing it, but we don't have the ability to understand it.
Right.
So we impose our own way of understanding.
Interesting. I'll tell you the language that he uses here in the Hebrew. He says she'ein anu masigim. We don't understand it, comprehend it. Ve'ro'im be'enei basar, and we don't see it with our physical eyes. He uses the word basar. Also means basar means like flesh, like fleshly, like our. It's not only physical. It means like. Meaty, like actual fleshly eyes, we don't see it. So maybe he's trying to emphasize that there's two issues here. One issue is a comprehension perception issue. We can't conceive of such a thing, so we don't even believe it. We impose meaning on it. Yeah, it's a tree, that's its own thing. But maybe even more so, maybe the physical eye, he's saying, can't see something that's not tangible. That's non-tangible.
Although the physical eye doesn't see.
Well, I mean, it doesn't take... I don't know.
I was thinking more like you were saying, like, you can't actually see what its true meaning is because every human being sees their vision is through their own perception. So the whole mind thing is... So we're not pure enough and clear enough to see the exact.
Right, but and the question is now, so is that just a limitation in perception or in the sight itself? I don't. I think he's trying to actually say both, but I'm open to, you know, I don't know.
Can I just make one comment?
Sure.
Regarding what Sandy's saying, there's something called a consensus reality.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we say this is a chair, and so because, so we give a meaning to this, so that what we see is that which we've all come to accept as a chair.
Right.
And that's
same, but there's a possibility for another thing that we
yes.
that we don't imagine. Interesting.
It seems to me there's a human, speaking as a scientist, there is evidence of the human need to make that perception.
Right.
In India, there's a common greeting is namaste, which means literally, I see God in you. And in general, there's a form of communication called phatic communication. And when we walk by somebody, we acknowledge their humanness, their beingness, by some kind of nonverbal nod, or as they do out in the country, driving their pickup trucks. they may not know you, but they recognize that you're human.
Right.
And the need to connect to each other.
That's very interesting.
To God.
That's very interesting. All right, good. Good, good, good. So, I guess however we understand it, the reality for us is the same, and that is that on a very basic level, we're missing out in our, either in our sight or our perception, we're missing out on a lot of what is real in the world. In other words, what we're seeing is only the most outward manifestation and result of the divine life force that's flowing through something. But what we see, no, I'm sorry, that's what we see. We see only the outward manifestation. What we don't see is the truth and the deeper force behind it. Let's continue. And again, we read these few paragraphs last time. We're just going to use this as a launching point into the new material. If, however, the eye were permitted to see and to comprehend the life force and spirituality which is in every created thing, flowing into it from that which proceeds from the mouth of God and His breath. In other words, if we could see, if instead of seeing a tree, right? The tree's right in front of me, that's why I'm using the tree. If instead of seeing a tree, we saw the divine life force, the utterance of God's mouth, so to speak, right? The life force, the divine life force, flowing into it. If that's what we saw, then the physicality, materiality, and tangibility of the creature would not be seen by our eyes at all. We wouldn't see a tree. We would see a divine life force, a divine energy, a divine light. And I used the example last time, when you have a camera lens, so you can focus it on the thing right in front of you, and the background is blurry, or you can focus it on the background and the foreground is blurry. And so the question is, what do we see? What are we focusing on? Are we focusing on the substance, not the substance, it's a bad word because it could mean either both things, the physical, outward, most external manifestation of the tree, which is the way a tree physically looks to us most of the time. And if we focus on that, then we're not seeing, well, I don't know if it's here or there, whatever, we're not seeing the divine life force, or do we focus on the divine life force within the tree, and then we don't see the tree as much. It's less tree, and it's more divine lifey. Right. For it, he says, because for it, in truth, the physicality of the thing, of the tree in my example, is completely nullified in relation, and here we use the word batal, nullified, it's completely nullified, it's not, it's absent, it's void, it's non-existent, in relation, it's all relative, right? He's not saying the tree doesn't exist. He says, in relation to the life force and the spirituality which is within it. Again, the point of this text is not to say that the tree doesn't exist, but rather to say that the tree, in the form that we typically see it, relative to its true existence, is not an existence. That's what he's saying.
That would explain why you, even in that state where, like the Alter Rebbe, when he saw the chair and all he saw was the divine light.
Right.
That would explain why you don't simultaneously see the chair and the light.
Right. You're pretty much seeing one or the other. Yeah. Right. What is your focus? Right. What is your focus? Is your focus on, do you see the outside or the inside? Right. It's like, you could, but that's what he's saying. He's saying, if you saw the inside, the truth, you wouldn't see the outside. That's what he's saying. If, however, the eye were permitted to see and comprehend the divine life force, then the physicality, materiality, intangibility of the creature would not be seen by our eyes at all. That's what he's saying. If you would see the truth, you wouldn't even see the tree as a physical tree. You wouldn't see it like that. You would see it solely and completely as the breath of God, as energy, as light, as whatever it is. It's like the Matrix, right? If you see it as, you know, the code, you see the code. If you see, it's kind of like if, and I gave this example before, software, you know, you code something and then, you know, an image comes up, or you code it and the colors change. So what are you looking at? I mean, you could look at both. You could have, like, you know, two screens up or two windows up, but one window has this and the other window has that. So it's like, so what are you looking at? If you're looking at the code, you're not looking at that. If you're looking at that, you're not looking at the code. So what do we see? Do we see? But again, it's a little more than just what we see. Objectively, the outside of a thing is completely nullified to the inside of it, because it doesn't exist without the inside. You don't need the outside for the inside. You need the inside for the outside, but not the other way around. Right? And so that's what Maimonides writes in his Foundations of Torah. I think the heating just stopped. It was getting a little hot in here, no?
It's getting hot.
It is.
I thought it was the Torah.
It's the Kabbalah and coffee again. Woo! So Maimonides writes in his Foundations, Fundamentals of Judaism, he writes that a big foundation of belief in God is that God, who and what is God? God is, by the way, it's almost like all of this, you can find it in Rambam, in Maimonides, in that section. Even though Maimonides wasn't, by his own admission, he wasn't a Kabbalist. He was a philosopher, but not a Kabbalist. But he speaks to these truths. He says, God is the true existence, Amitas Himatzoi, the true existence from which all other existence comes from, but by virtue of, but all other existence is not considered true existence because they need God to exist, but God doesn't need them to exist, which is exactly this point, right? Everything that exists only exists because of God's existence, because of this divine life force. God's existence doesn't need anything else to exist, right? The life force doesn't need the tree. It, as you said, it exists. The tree needs the life force. And again, it's not that the tree is not a tree, but the tree is nothing but the divine life force making it into a tree. So relative to the divine life force, the tree is not a tree. Relative to the divine life force, the tree is not a tree. Kind of like a middle of a paragraph here, but it's okay. Since without the spirituality within it, it would be not an absolute nothingness, exactly as before the 6 days of creation. In other words, it would be absolute nothingness and void, and emptiness, or not even emptiness, just absolute nothing, as before it was created. Okay, we'll just do the next paragraph or two very quickly. The spirituality that flows into it from that which proceeds from the mouth of God and His breath, in other words, the divine energy that flows into it, that alone continuously brings it forth from naught and nullity into being, and this spirituality gives it existence. That constitutes its reality. So the true reality, the true existence, the true being of being is the spiritual, divine, godly life force and not it itself. That's the point. Hence, as he summarizes this, hence there is truly nothing besides him in any created being, apart from the divinity, the only true reality that brings it into existence. In other words, there are verses in the Torah that say, Ein Od, or Ein Od Movado. There's nothing else besides for God. and you look around and you're like, I know a few things. What do you mean there's nothing else? I mean, there's nothing else. Of course there's something else. Good morning. Great. Good to see you. Welcome. So it says in the Torah two times. One time it says, Ein od milvado, there's nothing else besides for God. And the other time it says, Ein od, there's nothing else. And again, a person could ask, it's a nice catchphrase, there's only God, nothing else. What does it really mean? Of course there are other things. You look around, there's so many things. I'm looking at like thousands of things right in front of me. So what are you saying, there's nothing else besides for God? He says, based on all of this Kabbalistic explanation, we understand how that's actually true. Because nothing truly exists without God, so therefore there's nothing else besides for God. If you take God, if you remove God from the picture, nothing else exists. So there's nothing besides for God. Everything that exists only exists because of God. And it's not just because God originally created all this stuff and started it all off. It's because there's a divine life force continuously flowing through it at every moment. And without that divine life force, that entire being would collapse and disappear and be undone. Absolutely, the only existence is because of the divine life force. Therefore, there's nothing else besides for the divine life force. Make sense? Sort of? Okay. Now, we talk about the sun. Here we go. And here is our bright example. An illustration of this. Shining example. Luminescent. An illustration of this is the light of the sun, which illumines or illuminates the earth and its inhabitants. Okay, so let's do this slowly. So we have the sun. I told you before, I mentioned this earlier, he's going to now draw a distinction, and it's very important to get this concept, the structure. He's going to draw a distinction between the sun itself and the light of the sun that emanates from the sun. And you and I probably haven't spent too much time pondering that distinction, or that even there's such a thing as that as a distinction. What do you mean? The sun is shining. Hold on. There's two things. You have the actual sun, the body of the sun, and then you have the rays of light that emanate from the sun. So he's going to talk about what is the relationship between the ray of light, the ray of the sun, here on earth, and its source. The way the ray is here versus the relationship between the ray of the sun and the sun, the way the ray of the sun is found still inside the sun. Work with me on this. Yes? Sort of? Okay. We'll just go through it inside. He explains this pretty well. So far we have two things. The sun and the sunlight, the ray of the sun. This illumination, in other words, the sunlight on earth, is the radiance and the light which spreads forth from the body of the sun and is visible to all as it gives light to the earth and the expanse of the universe. Okay, let's make this less theoretical and more practical. So I'll invite you to look outside through the windows over there. Right? You look outside. You see light? Yeah. You see that car, the white car? There's light shining on that car? Yes? Okay, so there's sunlight that's shining on the car. There's sunlight shining on the Beltline. The dude in the red shirt walking with the headphones? Yes? Is he walking in the sun? Is the sun shining on him? Yes?
Yes?
Yes. Okay. That piece of light, that light that's on the car or on the person or on the jogger, on the walker, on the biker, whatever it is, or on the trees, that light is coming from sun. But it's no longer in the sun. If the light was still in the sun, we wouldn't have it. So clearly, there's light that's right here. Right? You stand outside, you put your hand out, and you feel the sun. You feel the sun's light. Okay, so there's light from the sun. Let's continue. Now, it is obvious that this light and radiance, the light of the sun and its radiance, is also present in the very body and matter of the sun globe itself in the sky. You know, when you were a kid, or maybe even now, when you draw a sun, a picture of the sun, what do? You draw a circle. You start off with a circle. And then what do? You draw the lines out. Okay, good. Perfect. Great. So you started from the body of the sun globe itself, right? You started from the body of the sun, and you drew it out. So imagine that ray, right? One of your rays goes all the way down to the grass and the tree and the little puppy that's playing, right? All the way down. You drew it all the way down. That's what it is, right? It goes all the way down, and now it illuminates that area. Fantastic. Here's a question. Does that light exist also in the body of the sun itself? Or does it only emerge now? It's not like there's a sun, and then suddenly light appeared. No. Obviously, the light is a continuum from the sun. So that ray of light that's on Earth also exists within the sun globe itself. The ray of light also exists within the sun itself. He continues, for, and here is his argument for this case, for if it can spread forth and shine to such a great distance, then certainly it can shed light in its own place. If the ray of light, how far is the sun from Earth? Do we know? Do we have an exact measurement here?
92 million miles.
That's a lot. That's crazy.
That in a day.
I've seen you drive, and you can't. Kidding. Just joking. 92 million, that's a lot. That's a lot of miles right there. Right? That's like...
Where are your jogging shoes trying?
I'm like getting, I don't know, that's a far distance. It's crazy that this whole thing works anyway. Whatever. So he says, if the ray of light can operate 92 million miles away from the globe of the sun and illuminate the Earth, if it can work all the way down here, certainly it illuminates in its source. Aha. However, this was all a setup. However, there in its own place, this radiance, the ray of the sun, the ray of light, is considered not and complete nothingness. In other words, you know the this is a joke, but it's an illustration. You know the guy who's the big macher in the community, but when he comes home, right? Right? You know, like, right? So like the ray of light on Earth, it's a celebrity. Oh, we love you, ray of light in the sun. Who are you? Who are you? We don't need you here.
Pick up your socks.
Yeah, what is this? Who are you? Get out of here. Like, who do you think you are? Big ray of light, big macher. This is the sun you're talking to. We don't need your rays of light. So again, the ray of light, the manifestation, that ray of light is beneficial out there. But put it back in its source where it certainly is, because that's where it's coming from, so it certainly is connected up there. In its source, that ray of light, come on. Are you kidding me? I'll give you another example. A flashlight. You're camping, right? You're out, what's the word when you camp, but like in a hotel? It's like glamping or something. Love that. That's more my style. Whatever, I'm just saying. So, okay.
It'd be a 4-star tent before I get
in. Right.
At home, the ray's parent says to it, be careful, you're going to burn yourself out.
Exactly. Oh, right. Be careful where you go. Don't forget to put on the suntan lotion. Anyway, or the earth, I don't know, earth block. So, imagine you're camping, and it's at night, and you're in the woods. Is the flashlight valuable?
Yes.
Of course it's valuable. It's your only way to see. The next morning, the sun is shining in the sky. You turn your flashlight. Does it do anything? It's irrelevant. It's bottle. It's nothing. It's nothing. It's absolute nothing. So imagine the ray of sun that's the big ray on campus on Earth. It's like, ooh, I'm the big ray of sun. You guys would all be dark without me. I'm amazing. You need me to live and to grow and I don't know, photosynthesis and whatnot and what have you, right? All, for all the trees and the plants and for all of this to work, you need my rays of light. Back home in the sun, that ray, you don't even see the ray. All you would see is the sun itself. However, in its own place, this radius is considered not in complete nothingness, for it is absolutely non-existent. Look at this. Ki batel mamash. You know what mamash means? Like literally, batel. It's literally nothing. Absolute non-existence in relation, not absolutely, it's still relative, right? In relation to the body of the sun globe, in other words, the sun itself, which is the source of this light and radiance. So, when it's out of its source, you see it as light. In the source, you don't see light, you see sun. See the difference? There's a ma'ar, I'll give you the Hebrew words. Well, shemesh is the Hebrew word for sun. But in the language more in the language of light, we would frame it like this. There's ma'ar and there's ar. Ma'ar is the source of light. Ar is the light. So out of its source, the ar is discernible. In other words, once the rays of light have emerged from the sun, the rays of light have emerged from the sun and are now illuminating the atmosphere, the earth, the tree, the plant, the person, whatever it is. So once it emerges, it has its own identity. It's light. We call it our light, sunlight. In its source, there's no light. There's only sun. There's mar. There's not ar. There's mar. There's source. It's not light. And any light that's there is batel mamish, is completely non-existent, nullified, absent, void, relative to the actual mar itself, to the actual sun itself. Make sense? Sort of? Yeah? Okay.
Is that one word,
ma'or? Ma'or, yeah. It's basically ar with a mem prefix. And ma'or, mem is usually from, but it's not from light, it's what light comes from. So it's the source from which light emerges. And again, outside of its source, it has its own identity. Inside its source, it's only the source. It doesn't have its a separate, discrete, distinct identity.
So the ray gives it its purpose and identity.
The ray plus distance equals its own identity. In other words, out of that globe of sun, it has its own identity, light. Inside, there's no identity of light, it's just sun. And any light
without
is...
Without the ray, the orb would have been different.
Correct. But one of the... Yeah, exactly. Without the ray... And it's almost like with the sun, it's not like you could have a source without that. I'm trying to think of another example.
Well, for me, it just gave me a whole other level of that whole Hasidic...
If you have that, you'll have that. I once saw, this is a little bit of a different example, so it's not. I don't mean this to be an exact analogy or parable or example, I just mean conceptually how sometimes you need one thing to have the other thing. I have this cup, right? This cup, right, with the A on it. What's the purpose of it?
To hold your drinks.
Yes, number one, but what else? What else is the point? It's to hold something. So which part of it do I need? Tell me, which part of it do I need?
The inside.
The inside. I need the inside. But I'll ask you a question now. Can I have an inside without an outside? Why not? I just want the inside. I don't want the outside. I don't need an outside. I don't want any of this outside. Forget what it looks like. I don't want an outside. I just want an inside. You can't have an inside without an outside. In other words, I created an inner space to hold my drink. There's going to be an outer space right behind it. No matter how thin it is, there's always an outer space.
Donuts are an exception. You can have the donut holes without the donut.
Oh, right. That's true. Donut holes are always... I was just in New Orleans last week. So they have the big thing there is beignets. Mm-hmm. Right? That's like the big... So there's this kosher... Now we're getting into it. All right. Now, huh? They have. So they have. Well, the place that we went to didn't have them, but there's another place that's kosher that does have them. There's a place called, it's called Waffles on Maple.
Oh, how cute is that?
So listen to this. There's Maple Street, So it's like, it's usually like, wait a second, it should be maple on waffle, right? Because I know maple syrup. I mean, come on, right? We know maple goes on the waffle. Who puts the waffle on the maple? That's crazy. Imagine you pour the maple and then you put the waffle on it. No, but it's Maple Street and it all works together. So listen to this. It's a tiny, tiny shop. The outside, the facade is shaped like a waffle. It's really funny. I have pictures I'll show you after the class if you care to see. But it actually is shaped like a waffle. The kids love climbing it. I'm kidding, they didn't. And they have, it's just waffles. Well, not just. Yeah, but it's tiny. It's like a tiny. Yeah, no, you could sit outside, or there's a little bit like kind of like just like along the wall, like kind of a bar-like seating on like along the side. But it's a really narrow place. But they make incredible bagels. They have sweet bagels, bagels, waffles. Sweet waffles, savory waffles. They make omelets. They make crepes. How do you pronounce it? Crepes. It's like. How do you pronounce it?
When I see the French way, people understand crap sometimes. So
crepe. All right, but listen. In Yiddish, we would call it blintzes, right? I think that's a blintz.
Back to the light.
No, hold on one second. So, what's my point? I actually have no idea how we got on this. Oh, beignets. Oh, that's it. All right, we're done. Anyway, it was good food. Everyone should go there.
There's no inside without an outside.
There's no inside without an outside. So there's no source, right? There's no source without an emanation, right? Like if you have a luminescent body like the sun, right, with all of the things, the gas, whatever, if it's luminescent, it's going to go out. The ray of light that's shining, a specific, if you're able to like, you know, mark off a specific ray of light shining on a specific quantifiable space on Earth, that ray of light is doing something positive at that moment in that time, in that space. And you can say that that's light. Right here, I see light. That light extends all the way back to the source. In the source, the light is batel mamish. The light is non-existent. It's just the source. Let's continue. It is only in the space of the universe, under the heavens, and on the earth, where the body of the sun globe is not present. In other words, it's only when you don't have the sun right there, and all that is seen is but an illumination that emanates from the sun, it's only then that this light and radiance appears to the eye of all beholders to have actual existence. The ray of light only seems to be, not seems, only looks real and appears as its own thing when it's not inside the sun, but rather is outside. So, if you're just talking about the sun itself, there's no light, it's just sun. When you move away from the sun, now you have a new entity called light. And even though you say, yeah, of course, but the light comes from the sun, but you're still calling it light. It's still a new thing. And that new thing only exists outside the space of the sun itself. And here, the term existence, yesh, which is being or isness, right? Yesh, existence, can truly be applied to it. Only outside of the sun can you apply the term yesh to the light. Whereas, let's continue, when it is in its source, in the body of the sun, the term existence cannot be applied to it at all. Oh, I'm so sorry. Pass this down, please. What page are we on in the...
32.
Thank you. Whereas when it is in its source, in the body of the sun, the term existence cannot be applied to it at all. It can only be called not and non-existence. It doesn't exist. The light doesn't exist in the sun. It only exists outside of the sun. Again, he's just continuing to elaborate on this example. There, in the sun itself, it is indeed not an absolute non-existent, for there, only its source, the luminous body of the sun, gives light, and there is nothing besides it. In other words, I don't like that the translation here. Only the luminous body of the sun gives light. It's more than that. All you have is the orb of the sun that is in itself you know, whatever it is, luminescent, but you don't have the expansion of the rays. That expansion only exists outside of the sun as a ray of light, but not in the sun itself. In the sun itself, you just have the sun, and outside you have now the rays. So imagine, here you have an example of something that in one place seems to exist, and in another place wouldn't seem to exist at all. Right? The ray on Earth, the ray of light on Earth exists, looks to exist. In the globe, the orb of the sun itself doesn't exist relative to the sun. Let's continue. Now he brings it back to the analog. The exact parable to this illustration is the relationship between all created beings and the divine flow of the life force that emanates from the breath of his mouth, which flows upon them and brings them into existence and is their source. Okay, hold on. That's a big sentence there.
I knew you were going to come
in. Yeah, we have to explain this. He says, first of all, he says the exact parallel to this illustration. Exact. Which means that he's not giving, in his own words, an imprecise, an inexact parable or example. He's giving you an exact illustration. He says, "Ukadvarm ha'ela mamish b'demusim ketsamim," exactly like their shape and form. It's not translated even all the details of how he describes this. It's exactly the same the way it exists in the world and with reality itself. Let's understand this. He says, is a relationship between all created beings and the divine life force that flows within it. Right? If we were to talk it outside before we read it inside, we would say that all created life, all created beings are like the ray of light outside of the sun. So outside of the sun, everything looks real. But trace it back inside the sun, it's not real. It's only the sun. So all create everything comes from the divine life force that flows into it. So outside of that divine life force, so to speak, it appears real. Relative inside the divine life force, it's not real. However, the created beings themselves are merely like a diffusing light and effulgence. Gesundheit. From the flow and spirit of God, which issues forth from him and becomes clothed in them and brings them from not into being. So what we have here is a very interesting interplay. In every created being, you have what appears to be, and then you have the divine life force that's actually in it and making it be. So he says, the thing that appears to be, like the tree, relative to the divine life force, is like the ray of light relative to the sun. It's absolutely not a nothingness. It only looks so because of some element of distance or space. But otherwise, in the space, direct space of the divine life force, this thing doesn't exist. All you see is the orb of the sun. All you see is the divine light, is the divine source of light that is making this be. Hence, their existence is nullified. And now he's talking about everything in existence. Their existence is nullified in relation to their source. Just as the light of the sun is nullified and considered not an utter nothingness, and is not at all referred to as existing when it is within its source, i.e. the sun. The term existence applies to it only beneath the heavens where its source is not present. The only time light becomes a thing is outside of the sun. In the sun, there's no light, there's sun. Out of the sun, when you don't have the sun, well, at least we have the light, now it's light. Same thing he says is true with all of existence, the entire universe, everything that we see. It all looks to be, and it all looks to exist when it's outside of its divine origin. Inside or relative to the divine origin, it's nothing. All you have is sun. All you have is divine light. All you have is divine energy. That's all everything is. But outside of that space, things appear to be. It's almost like, this is not a good example. Maybe it is a good example. You have a projector. A projector, right? A machine. Projecting light, projecting a video. Projecting a film against the screen. You look at the screen, you see people talking, things moving, you see action. Okay, there it looks real. Go inside the projector and look at the light bulb. It's just light, just the source. I know it's not precise because the light is projecting in different ways and whatever, even in its source, but I guess the core of that, I don't know, it's light, and its source, it's a light bulb. Over there, it's a whole scene. It's different. Anyway, his point is, it's probably not a good example. Well, let's stick with the sun and the light example. That's his example. He didn't use my projector example. So the example here he's saying is, again, the light, separate from its source, appears to be light. Back in its source, it's nothing. You only have source. The same thing is true with all existence. Existence outside of its source, so to speak, looks like it exists. It looks like a tree, it looks like a building, it looks like a rock, whatever it is, quote-unquote, outside. But inside its source, or relative to its source, it's absolute nothingness. However, are we up to however there in its own place? Is that what we're up to? Who remembers? No.
Hence?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I went back a page. I'm sorry. Hence, yes. Hence, their existence is nullified in relation to their source, just as the light of the sun is nullified and considered not an utter nothingness. Oh, I think we did this. And is not at all referred to as existing when it is within its source, i.e. the sun. Yeah, we did this. The term existence applies to it only beneath the heavens where its source is not present. And here we go. Let's get back to the analog to our point in the same manner. The term existence can only be applied to all created things only as they appear to our corporeal eyes. Look at this. He says, things only appear to exist the way we see them. For we do not see, nor at all comprehend the source, which is the Spirit of God that brings them to existence. Listen to this. When it comes to the sun and the light, what makes it sun or what makes it light is objective space and distance. If you're there, it's sun. If you're out there, it's light. What distinguishes between source and tree for us is not space. It's perception. Our perception creates the space that creates the distinction that creates in our minds the notion of a tree distinct from a divine life force. That's all our perception. Our perception is what creates the space. What is true of the sun, that up wherever the sun is, that's the sun. Outside of that is the light. That duality is created in the universe with our perception. Our perception constitutes the space that moves something from source to manifestation. What makes this a tree and not the source of the, and not a godly energy? Our perception. Straight up. That's what differentiates, that's what moves it out of source into something else, is our perception, our sight. Therefore, he says, since we do not see nor comprehend their source, right? Since we don't see the sun, so to speak, it appears to our eyes that the physicality, materiality, and tangibility of created things actually exist. Our minds move it from sun to light. Our eyes move it. Our eyes, our perception, move it. A thing from source, divine source, to tree, rock, anything.
Paper, scissors,
right? Just as the light of the sun appears to exist fully when it is not within its source and is found within the expanse of the universe. Again, what space does to the sun and light paradigm, our consciousness and perception does to God and the world. We see the world, existence, the universe, as a discrete, distinct, separate existence only because we don't see the source. That's all in our heads. Here we go. However, here we have a distinction between the two. And this is how we're going to end this class today. But in the following respect, the illustration is apparently not completely identical with the object of comparison. In other words, the universe is not like the sun. There's a distinction. Why? For in the illustration, in the example, the source, the sun, is not present at all in the expanse of the universe and upon the earth, where its light is seen as actually existing. In other words, when it comes to the sun and the light, on earth, you don't have a sun. The sun is not right here. All you have is the light. So now we understand why. When the sun is not here, the light emerges as its own, it seems to be its own existence, even though it's relative to the sun, it's nothing. But without the sun, it's a thing. So there's actual space to differentiate. By contrast, and here's the big question that we end the chapter with. By contrast, all created beings are always within their source. You can't say that the tree, like the ray of light, is outside its divine source. On the contrary, all creation, all created beings are always considered to be inside their source. The divine, i.e. the divine activating force, which is continuously found within them, constantly creating and animating them, ex nihilo, something from nothing. And it is only that the source is not visible to our physical eyes. Why, he asks, are they not nullified in their source? In other words, we said before that objectively, in the space of the sun, the light doesn't exist. So he asks, if that's true with sun and light, why is that not true with existence? In other words, if the tree, the physical tree that appears to be, if that tree is constantly inside its divine life force, which it is, so how do we even see it as a tree? How in the world can it even look like anything other than the source? What he's trying to say is, if we imagine the universe, if we imagine like God as the sun, and then everything else is emerging, and it looks like it's on its own, but really if you go back, it's really part of a source, but as it emerges, it looks on its own, like the light looks like its own entity from the sun, even though it's nothing relative to the sun, right? If that's how we understand it, fine. But he says, here's the question. The entire universe is inside the sun. The entire universe, all of existence, is always and constantly inside its source. If so, how does it even appear to our eyes as though it's a separate and discrete and distinct identity? Question make sense? How does it even look to us like a tree? When it comes to the sun and the sunlight, we said the sunlight looks like light because the sun is not here. But if God is right here, right? Like the children's song, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. If God's light, if God's presence is everywhere, inside the tree, around the tree is inside of it, so how does the tree even look like a tree in the first place? That's the question. To understand this, some prefatory remarks are necessary, and that's how he ends chapter 3. So Chassidim say the following. Tanya, of course, is the Bible of Hasidic and mystical philosophy. So Chassidim say the following. You never end with a question. It's dangerous to end a study session with a question. But when is that true? Only when it's a question about God. Questioning God's existence, you never want to end the session questioning, how could God be if there... But this is questioning our existence. And that's okay to end with that question. This chapter ends with the question, how do we exist if we're inside the sun? How are we even self-conscious? How are we even aware of ourselves or aware of a tree if we're inside the sun, if we're inside the source? How do we have that separateness of consciousness, of perception, of sight, if everything is always constantly inside the source of light, the source of life itself? So the question is, how do we exist? How do we perceive our own existence? Forget how do we exist. We exist because God makes us exist. But how do we perceive that as separate from the source, if we're inside the source? If you tell me that there's a source, but we're outside the source, fine, sun and light, I get it. There's a construct there. There's a precedent, there's a physical mirror of that. But if you tell me that all of existence is constantly found inside the source, how could it not see the truth? Or how could, more precisely, how could we ever see ourselves as anything else other than the sun? Or how do we see anything other than, when I say the sun, I mean the source, how do we see anything other than the source? For that, we'll explain further as we go through this text. So again, ending with a question is okay, as long as the question is, how do I exist? You know why? Because if we went through our days thinking, a little bit less about our existence, we would be a little bit upset at the person who cut us off, because who did they cut off anyway? If I don't exist, right? Who am I to get upset, right? And somebody says something or does something or whatever it is, or something doesn't go exactly the way I thought it would go. Does any of this exist anyway? So we'll be a little bit more able to handle the challenges of life. Yeah.
No, I came in the middle. It seems to me like what I heard is an argument for the existence of God.
Well, really, the premise here is the existence of God. The question is, how do we exist? That's really the question that we're asking. In other words, if we posit that God is the only true existence, and everything else is but a manifestation of God's reality, and without God's reality, nothing else could exist. If that's the case, then why does anything look to be its own separate existence? How could it look like its own separate thing if it's all a manifestation of God? And if you tell me, yeah, well, there's a sun and there's a light, and the outside of the sun, the light looks like its own thing, fine, but we're still inside the source. So if we're still inside the source, how do we perceive ourselves as ourselves? To this, he answers, ultimately, the answer is going to be a word that some of you may know, a very important Kabbalistic concept known as Tzimtzum. But we'll get there. We have some ways to go. Thank you very much for joining me this morning for K&C, Kabbalah and Coffee.